Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Donald Trump's emotion machine is taking a dip this radio hour in Lauren Berlant's field tank. Not think tank, notice. Because the late Professor Berlant, in a famous and influential hothouse of emotional studies at the University of Chicago, decided that our politics and our personal relationships, our path to happiness, are all fogged in by feelings we mostly misread, our stumbling blocks, our past attachments to fantasy and false hopes. Recovery, if it comes, is in saying goodbye and moving on. Welcome to Affect Theory, as Lauren Berlant embodied it. It's touchy-feely and literary, not scientific. Above all, it's intuitive, akin to reading a room full of people for emotions like anger or affection before anyone's spoken, identifying a mood or a movement in the crowd. Our three guests fell under Lauren Berlant's spell as students, years before Berlant's death this summer of a rare cancer at the age of 63. What the students typically remember is the moment when they felt Lauren Berlant was getting personal, writing or talking to them, about them. They speak of Berlant using gender-neutral pronouns, they and them, as Berlant did late in life. Maggie Dougherty teaches writing now at Harvard in the glow of a fine study she published last year about poets and artists interacting in the 1960s. Maggie is recalling a flash of recognition with Lauren Berlant.
So that's what I experienced as a graduate student in English after the recession in 2008, in a time when it was really, really clear to everyone that making a good life in higher education, making a good life in academia, was basically impossible. There was this real awareness that if you were to go to graduate school, especially in the humanities, it was going to be incredibly difficult for you to ever find job security, any kind of stability, any kind of employment that wasn't an adjunct gig that you were going to have to, you know, scrape and claw for to get. Right. And yet we all were still doing it. We were all still in graduate school, working our butts off, fretting about our research, making sure that our dissertations were original enough to be exciting, but trendy enough to speak to things that people were talking about. And we were all, I think I speak for most of the people in my cohort, incredibly anxious, incredibly depressed, incredibly angry. But for some reason, that didn't compel us to leave. Mm. And so when I read Lauren Berlant's work, Cruel Optimism, I felt like they were describing the emotional and psychological experience that I was having as a graduate student. I was attached, very, very deeply attached to a certain life in academia that was actively harmful for me. Mm. It was preventing my flourishing, to use Berlant's words. But I couldn't really give up the idea, or the fantasy, as they would say, that this beautiful intellectual life that I'd imagined for myself might still be available to me. So when I read that book, it was really one of those light bulb moments where I think, oh my gosh, suddenly I understand. And not only do I understand, I can talk about my experience in a new way.
Do you want to connect it to a personal relationship you are in?
Do I want to? Well, I think I probably should. One of the great things about Berlant's work is that they moved so fluidly between the interpersonal and the local and the ordinary and the national and the geopolitical, and they could as easily be theorizing life under capitalism as they could theorize life in a really unstable or non-reciprocal relationship. And these things, I think, had the same affective or emotional experience for them, or at least they called attention to the ways that, you know, scrambling to make a living under capitalism can feel like scrambling to get love from someone who doesn't want to love you the way you want to be loved. And so, yes, at the time I was in graduate school, I was in one of those non-reciprocal relationships. And again, was attached, was invested, was paralyzed, was stuck. And it felt like Berlant's theory of the cruelly optimistic, and I should say that it's cruel, or optimism is cruel in Berlant's work when it is harmful for you to maintain it. I felt like both of these experiences I was having were really explained, or at least kind of lit up in a new way by this theory I was reading. And really, that's, I think, one of the best things that theory can do for us as readers and why we stick with it even when it's kind of difficult.
That phrase, cruel optimism, is so incredibly powerful because it can apply to almost anything. Being stuck in a situation, nothing's working, like our politics say, for example, like COVID and viruses yet to come. What's the trick that will get us out of this miserable situation? And the problem is we tend to look back and we kind of know that disappointment is coming. We were thinking, how many examples can you think of people in this situation? Simone Biles, for example, Naomi Osaka, hyper-competitive, successful people, but there's some misery in there that they can't deal with. And suddenly, it's over. In those cases, I would say those are corrections against cruel optimism. So many more people sort of stay stuck. But what are your other examples?
I think working in media, honestly, could be an example of cruel optimism. One of the ways that we develop our fantasies or our visions of the good life, you know, comes from history. And there were moments in the United States when working in various industries, intellectual industries, literary industries, like journalism, media, academia, could result in what we tend to think of as a good life. And that might mean security, economic security, a home, stability, a community. And this was kind of facilitated by some of the policies of the mid-century, the ways that the state, the welfare state, was available for more people in more ways. Those conditions no longer obtain, right? We don't have a robust welfare state. We don't have protections for people in their workplaces. The labor movement has decreased in power. Venture capital now owns a ton of media organizations and is selling them whenever it's convenient. And so these routes toward a kind of American good life, an American-style good life, are really closed off to us. But that often doesn't prevent people from working in media, from becoming journalists, from becoming writers, from making podcasts, from doing this kind of work that we feel attached to or we feel compelled to do. And I guess the question is, you know, how much of our attachment ends up really destroying us or hurting us in ways that we might recognize, but might not really have a vision of what could be done differently.
I'm reminded of that famous old line about second marriages, a triumph of hope over experience. So many things fit into this kind of cruel optimism. I'm thinking condo living in Florida after Surfside, every kind of addiction. The American dream, you could take that apart in terms of cruel optimism.
So, I mean, I think cruel optimism speaks to so many different contemporary experiences. I think we can see it in terms of the ways we're responding to climate change. So right now it is fire season in California. We are watching more floods occurring on the East Coast of the United States. We've seen this happening for the last few years, and yet developers haven't chosen to stop building in these danger zones. There's still this real attachment to the idea that we should be able to enjoy and to use the land as we choose. And even as so many of us are looking with horror at the ways that the climate has caused this really extreme weather, and people are suffering, animals are suffering, the land is suffering, and yet some of the same behaviors, condo development in Miami, for example, hasn't stopped. That's an example of exactly what Brilliant was talking about, the fantasies we have about the good life and about what is needed to be happy are so strong that we collectively continue to engage in behaviors that are actively preventing our kind of enjoyment or pleasure or safety in the present moment and in the future. It's useful to understand optimism as not always a positive experience, that the optimism of staying in a certain situation could be painful or upsetting or disrupting in some way, you know, looking at different instances in which we don't necessarily see people being hopeful or happy can still be an example of cruel optimism.
And you get excited and optimistic about finding a new job in a tech startup. then you remember you've been through 9 instances before and they didn't work. I mean,
it's the repeating things that don't work for you, certainly. There is a kind of element of repetition compulsion here. Yep. You know, you might not feel excited. You might not feel optimistic. You might not be thinking, oh my gosh, I'm so happy to be doing this. There might be something else kind of keeping you applying for those jobs, keep you working in those industries, even if the experience itself is not one of excitement or hope. Mm. That's a useful thing to remember, because we often find ourselves in situations where we feel kind of actively unhappy, or when our attachment to something, whether it's a job or a lover or a family or anything else, is not experienced as a positive attachment. It might be experienced as a negative attachment or a hostile attachment. The experience itself might not be a pleasant one, but the fact that we can't leave it, that we can't detach from it or imagine a different way of relating to that object, whatever it is a sign of the sort of power, the optimism, the sort of underlying belief that something could change in the situation that we're in.
It can work at all sorts of scales. I am reminded of American intervention in the Third World since 1945, the sort of dream of American empire crashed in Vietnam, but it never stops. It was reborn in Iraq. We've licked the Vietnam syndrome, said George Bush Sr. It applies in Afghan too. No, we'll bring them democracy. We'll bring them something better. We brought them war. And we're incredibly wary now of our own power. I mean, that may be a lesson learned.
Sure, there's definitely an element of repetition in American history. The continual belief in American hegemony and the desire to continue to enact that all over the world, even when it backfires, as you've suggested, backfires in ways that have consequences not just for the people living in the United States, but for people in many countries all over the world, for the climate of the world as a whole, etc. The fact that these acts get repeated does suggest some sort of optimism, some sort of fantasy of a better outcome for the United States, certainly, and maybe there's even a fantasy of a better outcome for everyone. Democracy in all corners of the world, and freedom in all corners of the world, despite the evidence that that's not what's actually coming to pass.
The trick, Lauren Berlant said, the trick was how to say goodbye and move on. And it applies both to individuals and all kinds of institutions. Coming up, the heartbreak of cruel optimism in Lauren Berlant's own voice. This is Open Source. It's an uncanny feel for the strangeness of what we're all going through in the 2020s that leaps out in hindsight on the Chicago sage and scholar Lauren Berlant. Cruel Optimism was the book title that can still work as a key to Berlant's thinking. Here's a spoken condensation of the phrase in Berlant's telling from the University of Chicago podcast, Big Brains.
Cruel optimism is when you're attached to objects or object worlds or forms of life that fundamentally get in the way of the attachment you brought to them and of the optimism you brought to them. For me, it's a heartbreak that the world isn't worth our attachment to it, that it gives us objects or ways of life or forms of life that are constantly betraying us. The easiest example of this is a broken heart. So you saw in another person, or you saw in your family, or you saw in your kids, or you saw in some form of kinship, the possibility of a kind of mutuality and staying attached to the world. And then when that doesn't last 30 years, or when it only lasts 2 weeks, or when you realize you haven't fundamentally been recognized in a way that you can bear, the fear is that when you lose that relation, you would lose your world. If you break a pencil, you don't say, I'll never write again. But when your heart breaks, you say, like, I don't know if I can go on. I don't know if I can bear more loss. And right now we have the problem of the kind of capitalist betrayal of people's sense that there would be continuity and there would always be upward mobility.
Anahid Nersesian, Lauren Berlant was your teacher and your mentor in many ways at Chicago. But then you ended up with Professor Berlant in a very open-minded book group. What does that get to tell you about your teacher, your friend?
You know, I think that Lauren was always interested in community, but one of the great lessons of the reading group and the reason that they encouraged us to form it in the first place and the reason that they were interested in joining it and supporting it is Lauren was very suspicious of institutions. Lauren did not think that any institution was a place that necessarily sponsored the flourishing of individuals. Mm. And so the reading group, which was called Affective Publics, I wish we had given it a better name, but, you know, Affective Publics existed as a safe haven, a kind of safe space for graduate students that did not necessarily feel welcomed in their home departments, either because they were doing work that was a little bit against the grain, or maybe because in their own persons, in their own lives, they represented things that were uncomfortable, you know, because they were sexually dissident or because they were queer or because they were politically quite radical. And so for various reasons, felt that they just didn't fit in. And so Affective Publics was a little bit like the island of broken toys. It wasn't a group centered around Lauren's work in any way. It was a group that was very directed by graduate student interest. And so we read widely and we read quite experimentally, and we really formed a community with one another. And I think that, you know, one of the things all of us have learned is we've dispersed to various parts of the world, some of us continuing on in academia and some of us not, is that we continually are looking to find something like that group elsewhere, and we haven't been able to recreate it yet.
What was the Berlant theory of community? And in what sense are you working it out, making it as you go? Scholars in different parts of the country, no specific target of interest, but a handle on all of it.
You know, I think that Maggie spoke really beautifully about the ways in which Lauren's work teaches us to at least want to leave situations that are toxic. But the trick about community is very messy. It's very difficult to be with other people. Other people are complicated. Other people are different from us. Other people see things in different ways, and they have desires that we might find distasteful or unruly. But if we've made a commitment, a kind of baseline commitment to trying to be with one another, and that's a social commitment, but it's also a political one, how do we manage our difference from others? And a lot of Lauren's work was directed toward that. And if optimism now has become too much of a loaded word for us to apply in reference to Lauren and to their work, we might say instead that it had a utopianism to it. You know, I think that Lauren fundamentally believed that people could live together even when it was difficult, that they could make lives together even if those lives were imperfect, and they could be in a relation to one another that could evolve, that didn't need to be fixed or static, and that also didn't need to be saturated by certain paradigms of judgment or rejection. So, you know, I think that that's really the sort of Berlant model of community, is it's something that we have to keep showing up for even when it is uncomfortable.
I want to know more about the we in that reading group. Specific books, for example, or politics, or pop culture, or sports, or the news from Washington or anyplace else?
So it would be all of those things. I want to say that we met once a month. A couple of people would volunteer to curate the meeting, and so they would select a series of objects for everyone to sort of consume before the meeting, and then we would get together, and we would discuss those objects kind of late into the night. You know, the meetings would sometimes go for, you know, 4 or 5 hours and often continue on, you know, at the bar or whatever. It was everything. We would listen to Bjork, or we would watch Kenneth Anger film, or we would watch a documentary like Harlan County, USA. And we would read polemics from French theorists like Alain Badiou, you know, something quite rarefied, something quite difficult and high theoretical, and then also just, again, a pop cultural objects. I don't remember any sports.
Could it be funny? Did people talk about their relationships, troubled or not?
I know that I often sought out Lauren when I was having relationship problems. You know, Lauren had a sort of secret ambition to be a therapist and would often serve that role for students, though not in an appropriate or boundary-crossing way. You know, I mean, Lauren was somebody who had a ton of life experience and had a kind of wild life. They had lived on a commune. They had been married and divorced. They were queer. They had entered into a very long-term and loving relationship with a partner somewhat later in life. And so they could really offer a great deal of perspective and, you know, quite original insights on whatever was going on with you when you were like me, you know, sort of 25 and bumbling around in the world and trying to figure out what you wanted from intimacy or what you wanted from love. And the other thing is actually quite interesting is Lauren was once approached by a literary agent to write a self-help book. And I was all for it. I encouraged them to do it. And I said, you know, people read your books as self-help manuals anyway. A book called The Female Complaint, which is the second in the so-called National Sentimentality Trilogy, was for me, when I was in my 20s, really a kind of guide to living. So, you know, yes, absolutely, people would talk about their relationships. And we laughed all the time in our reading group. That is probably my overarching memory of that experience, was it's like how much laughter and how much comedy there was in it. And, you know, I think comedy was something that Lauren was very interested in, partly because laughter is this very curious thing. It can have a lot of aggression in it, right? You know, people can laugh in a way that's mocking or cruel. But you can also laugh as a way to transition from a state of discomfort to a state of repair. Oh, we'll laugh about it. Someday we'll laugh about this. Or I'm willing to laugh this off. Anyone who's ever been in any kind of long-term relationship, either with an individual or with a group, knows that laughter comes in handy.
Zach Samelin, you were a colleague of Lauren Berland, and you're extending the vision in your own work. You're writing today about Victorian literature. Immediately, I think Dickens. I think this love affair and favorite writer in his time. But he wrote about sordid London. He wrote about terrible suffering, including his own as a child. You're writing about an aesthetic of disgust in Victorian art in general. Spell that out as an inheritor of the Lauren Berland eye, in some sense. And in terms of books, David Copperfield, our mutual friend, Bleak House above all, there is something of cruel optimism in Dickens's voice.
Yeah, well, one of the most exciting things to me about Lauren's work is the sort of historical dimension. There's this sense in which our desires and our fantasies and our attachments are historically rooted. And one of the things that I got out of reading Lauren's work in graduate school was to be sent back to the 19th century as, in a sense, the scene of the crime when a lot of the fantasies that continue to hold sway were installed. Mm-hmm. And for me, the particular cast that took was to study the centrality of disgust to social experience in the middle of the 19th century in Britain. I mean, Lauren was really focused on America, but there was a number of Lauren's works that were very influential to me. In particular, there's a wonderful essay from the 90s called The Subject of True Feeling, where Lauren's really thinking about the way that appeals to feeling and collective appeals to feeling can have a sort of organizational effect on political life and social life. And in Dickens's London, disgust was one of those feelings that really did have an organizational function. You see, in the summer of 1858, for example, there was a sewage crisis, as Dickens put it in Little Dorrit, through the heart of town, a vile sewer ebbed and flowed. Then you had this public outcry. Oh, like, this is an absolutely disgusting experience that 3 million people are sort of smelling their own filth. And that led to a really big legislative process that in turn led to the construction of the first modern sewer system. So, you know, that's a sort of, I think, particularly clear example of the way that an appeal to emotion or a collective appeal to emotion can have a political outcome.
Yeah, and Dickens's London also being a place where every reader's nostalgia, in some sense, is rooted and founded, no? I mean, we revere that time, and he's telling you just how dirty it was.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting to me about that moment in the middle of the 19th century is that, again, it's one of the moments when a lot of our political expectations begin to emerge, and a lot of the infrastructures that we continue to be attached to are first constructed, right? Public transportation, public education, mm-hmm. the idea of, you know, increasing commitment to extending the franchise, and so on and so forth, labor politics, the labor movement, these all begin to emerge in the middle of the 19th century. Now, I think one of the things that cruel optimism made clear was, well, there can be some negative consequences to remaining committed to fantasies that are 170 years old, right? And the desired outcomes may not be forthcoming. And Anahid, I totally agree with you that there was a real utopian facet to Lauren's thinking, which was necessary because of how clearly Lauren understood the false promises of political desire.
Let's talk about Lauren Berland's theories of political desire. Brilliant on the subject of Donald Trump. I mean, really brilliant in August of 16. Took him very seriously. Not tempted very much by the Clinton record in NAFTA, other aspects of a kind of neoliberal modern democratic politics. But what Berlant saw was that Trump was drowning his real message in a kind of word salad kind of babble, but the core signal was about freedom, and he pulled it off. Can anybody explain that?
You know, there's a line in a book that Lauren wrote with the anthropologist Kathleen Stewart called The Hundreds, and the line is, "There's nothing I like more than watching someone use their freedom." And I think that what Lauren understood about Trump, and you sort of said this already, but is that he managed to excite people with the spectacle of his own use of his own freedom. Yeah. So he said whatever came to mind, no matter how hateful, no matter how stupid, no matter how ill-informed. And there's an exhilaration to that. You know, it's the same delight we have in a sense of watching a child play or a dog play. Right. And so in that sense, he was able to, I think, insulate himself in the sheer pleasure, the kind of sheer, again, exhilaration of watching him do all these crazy things, say all these crazy things. And for that reason, nobody took him seriously for a very long time. But I think that what Lauren saw is how desperately people want to feel their own freedom. Yes. And so they will settle for watching someone else experiencing it for them. You know, some of Trump's rhetoric basically encouraged his audience to believe that the reason you can't feel free is because of political correctness or cancel culture. The reason that you can't feel free is because of immigrants taking your job, right? The reason you can't feel free is because there is a conspiracy of coastal and global elites, you know, who run the world, right? So, you know, he kind of convinced people that if you followed him, you too would be able to experience the kind of freedom that he demonstrated. And so I think that's what Lauren saw as a serious threat.
Here's Lauren Berlant writing, "The Trump emotion machine is delivering feeling okay, acting free, being okay with one's internal noise and saying it and demanding that it matter. Internal noise matters." And the PC question. He said, "We don't have time for political correctness." Berlant said, "Anti-PC means," to his audience, "I feel unfree and I don't like it. But Trump is demonstrating I'm free. I can do it. Watch me."
I would just add to that that I think Lauren really had a clear sense that freedom for most people involves the freedom to be violent. I mean, you know, maybe not for most people, but for many people, there was a real sense of license to be aggressive. That was a fairly explicit part of Trump's rhetoric. You know, I think a lot of mainstream political discourse likes to imagine that aggression is not something that needs to be dealt with in a certain, you know, liberal political discourse. The police are the people who are supposed to manage aggression. And I think Lauren really was unapologetic about that. I think Lauren really saw that people liked the idea that they could be aggressive and violent and understood that that needed to be accounted for in the way that we thought about politics and political life.
You know, I didn't read Lauren Berlant on that 2016 campaign until 5 years later. But all I can think of is, A, it was just incredibly true, penetrating, accurate about him, about us, or a lot of us. And I keep thinking, what if the New York Times or anybody else figured out a way to cover politics that way? This is, above all, an emotional contest. It's not about your tax policy. It's not even about your record as governor of Illinois or whatever. It's about the way you make me feel. And he grabbed it, probably without studying it. What if we could learn to cover or see politics that way and report it?
I think one of the great insights of affect theory in Berlant's work and in the work of other scholars who work on this is that feelings are not necessarily coming from us as individuals, right? They might be something that's just in the air. You know, the way that all of us probably feel a little bit anxious all the time right now because there's just a lot of anxiety floating around. And that what we might be experiencing in our own lives might be coming kind of from someplace else or coming from somewhere that is unexpected. In other words, I think what our current political coverage often says is, well, here's what's actually happening. Therefore, things are okay, or therefore, things are not okay. When what people might be picking up on in their emotional life is something else. So, I mean, I'm thinking, I guess, of Clinton's, you know, "America is already great," right? Is that, was that the sort of countervailing slogan? I feel like I've repressed that campaign to such a degree that I can't even remember. But you can't tell people who are feeling not okay, that actually, according to all these measurements, all these, you know, the amount of money they're making in a given year, or actually, you know, how many job opportunities they do have, or actually what their debt level is, no, you're doing okay. If what they're picking up on emotionally is that things are not okay and that they are not okay. To be talking about emotion in politics, it can't be about convincing people to feel ways that they do not feel, often for very good reason. I think the other kind of insight is that our feelings, our emotions are often coming out of material circumstances. They're not, you know, they're coming out of life under late capitalism. They're coming out of, you know, life on the eve of some kind of climate apocalypse. So, which are very real material conditions that produce anger and anxiety and paranoia and envy and all of these, what another wonderful affect theorist, Yen Nai, calls ugly feelings that we have about our lives. It wouldn't necessarily be doing away with kind of the real and the rational and shifting to the emotional in order to talk about politics this way, but maybe it would mean redirecting our attention to certain conditions, to certain corporations, to certain governing bodies that are producing these very real emotional experiences for people, so that maybe the discussion is not sort of what is this one political leader doing or not doing, but what is this system that we're living in doing or not doing? What is capitalism doing or not doing for us?
Coming up, Into That Fuel Tank with Lauren Berlant and company. This is Open Source. Maggie, Zach, Anahit, let's talk about affect theory. Lauren Berlant did not invent it, but how do we compare it to, say, Freudian or Marxist, for that matter, or any other kind of school of analysis and therapy? Who can explain where affect theory comes from and what it means for me?
One way to think about affect theory is as a way of knowing. One of the things that our emotions do, before we can put names on them, before we can say, I'm feeling sad, or I'm feeling angry, or I'm feeling anxious, and this is why, the first thing they do is they help us sense our environment. So, you know, when you walk into a room that someone is angry, maybe angry with you, or you know when you walk into a room that people have just been talking about you. How do you know those things? You know them on a physical level. And so how do we come to put certain names on those sensations? You know, how do you come to name the tension in the room as anger? How do you come to name the tension in the room as somebody was just talking about me? Affect theory is interested in connecting the dots between those things, between a kind of physical responsiveness, a way of sensing the world, and then a way of labeling the world, organizing the world.
I'm still trying to figure out, Anahit, how to use Lauren Berlant in our post-Trumpian politics. Berlant said the trick is understanding that politics is not simply transactional. I'll vote for you and you'll get my industry back and my job and my income. And neither is it pragmatic. It's not judging by past results. Berlant would say it's overwhelmingly emotional. Do you make me feel good? And in that marvelous piece on Trump in 2016, Berlant wrote, here's the thesis of this piece. People would like to feel free. It's that simple. That ought to be on the New York Times page one sometime.
Good luck with that.
Or CNN maybe.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's a complexity to Lauren's thought that I think is not easily digestible and makes it somewhat unsuited to the kind of analysis that you find on the pages of the New York Times. I mean, they did write an op-ed for The Nation called Against Sexual Scandal. And even that, I think you would be sort of hard-pressed to find.
Spell that out. I'm dying to hear the point.
Well, so let's see if I can make it pithy. Against Sexual Scandal is an op-ed that Lauren wrote after Eliot Spitzer, the erstwhile governor of New York, my home state, was found to have paid women for sex and, you know, as a result, had to resign as governor. And the Spitzer event came on the heels of a number of sexual scandals that had involved high-profile politicians and a number of right-wing conservative evangelical politicians. And Lauren's op-ed says, you know, people jump on these examples because we all know that politicians are generally bad people and that they enact policies that are inimical to our happiness and inimical to, you know, us finding better ways to live. And so we like to see them go down. But the other thing that's going on here is a kind of generalized disgust for sex. And so Lauren says in that op-ed, when these things happen, I feel bad for sex. Because in a better world, we wouldn't be so riled up by the notion of people finding their sexual pleasure here or there. In a better world, we wouldn't judge people for having sexual preferences that make no sense to us. We would simply, you know, kind of live and let live, right? I think the line in the op-ed is something like, what would it be like to live in a world where we thought that sex was basically a good thing? We don't live in that kind of world because the world is set up to variously punish people for having pleasurable experiences or set up to restrict people's pleasurable experiences to make sex something that is unsafe. What if we lived in a world where sex was basically a good thing? And that, I think, is also kind of at the core of a lot of Lauren's utopianism. You know, she did come out of queer theory. And in the early days of queer theory, that was also a very, very important aspect of that kind of thought, to kind of destigmatize sex and sexuality. But you would be very, very hard-pressed to find an argument like that in the op-ed pages of the New York Times.
I wonder if you'd each sort of testify from your own personal experience, reading, teaching, knowing Lauren Berlant, the lesson for community, and I mean that very broadly. Lauren Berlant was idealistic about teaching communities, school communities, for all their traps. But I'm just wondering, in partnerships, local community, digital community of the far-flung like yourselves, what is the ideal that we could all learn from Lauren Berlant? A different way of thinking of ourselves as connected human beings.
You know, one of the things that I learned from Lauren on a personal level is the necessity of trying to get beyond knee-jerk judgments of people with whom we come into conflict. Lauren was quite interested in Buddhism. And, you know, the sort of paradigmatic program of Buddhist thought is the suspension and removal of judgment. And so I think that's a very, very important lesson that I learned from Lauren, that you could end a relationship with somebody without deciding that they were the worst person in the world, that you don't have to produce a kind of like dissertation about why this person was horrible and toxic and vicious. You could simply remove yourself, you know, and you could simply reorient yourself toward a better kind of relationship or a better kind of life. That's something that I've taken with me and that has enabled me, again, just personally, to leave open space for relationships to change, relationships to end, but also relationships to take a new form, whether it's an intimate or sexual relationship or a friendship or a professional relationship. So I think that always in Lauren's life and in Lauren's character, there was a belief that things might be different and better. If you can hold on to that thought, when you're in the midst of an interpersonal conflict, you know, or if you're, you know, working in activism, which a lot of Lauren's students did, you can get quite far.
I sense that it's a question on many, many minds in this moment, after a year and a half of living at a distance or living someplace else, coming back and thinking, how do we want to live? AOC, one example, made a headline a couple of months ago saying she wasn't sure she'd run for office again. She was drawn more and more to homesteading, a different kind of community making. But I think that sort of fantasy is teasing a lot of us these days. What's to learn from Lauren Berlant, Maggie Daugherty?
One of the last talks I heard Lauren give was on the idea of the commons. But I remember that, you know, here we are not far from Boston Common,
right?
The green space where everyone showed up to graze their animals, and they were a community there. And I remember Lauren's argument about the commons was that you just had to show up,
right?
That this is how a community was instantiated or brought into being, and it's outside of institutions. There's not a university or a corporation bringing people together and kind of sanctioning the bonds among them. It was a different kind of community formation where you voluntarily and organically came to be among others and came in that way to have obligations to each other, to have obligations to the collective.
And nobody owns it, Maggie.
Right, exactly. What it reminds me of is Occupy, the Occupy movement, where people showed up to be together in claimed space that was ultimately public space, whether that was Dewey Square or Zuccotti Park, and said, you know, this is now our commons. We are on the common together in that way. And I think that idea of the commons has always stuck with me, in part because it was the last time I heard Brilliant speak and was moved and awestruck by it, as I always was, because I think it has this kind of inevitability to it. We are all in this together, whether we want to be or not. We are all in this pandemic together. We are all in climate change together. That way of thinking outside of institutions, of thinking kind of openly, non-judgmentally, and, you know, collectively, does feel like really a part of Berlant's legacy to me.
Zach Samelin, I want your distillation of the Berlant lesson going forward about community.
You know, I worked with Lauren for 8 years in the English department at the University of Chicago within an institution that was decidedly not utopian. You know, Lauren was a great theorist of the sort of carnage of neoliberalism.
The Chicago School meets the Chicago School.
Yeah. One of the things Lauren would say often was that you fight from where you are, but you do have to have horizons that are radically different from the world that you live in.
How did Lauren Berlant manage to be both disruptive and a communitarian?
Well, I think that when you're in an institution whose ideas of order can be either repressively managerial or stultifying in some way, then being disruptive is sort of the only way to produce a community. Disrupting business as usual at the University of Chicago, you know, an institution that congratulates itself on having staffed Pinochet's Treasury Department. You know, disrupting that institution's business as usual, I think, is a really important act on behalf of political community. But you have to show up. I mean, I remember Lauren once telling me that it was important that I figure out a way to sit in my chair at department meetings so that I could put my feet on the table. Because you have to have a foot on the table. And I was like, okay. You know? So I think that there was really a whole range of tactics that Lauren deployed to disrupt things so that you could see things in a new way.
In so many accounts of Lauren Berlant, the enemy and the illustration of cruel optimism was neoliberalism, which we associate broadly since the 70s with the withdrawal of public supports for people and a cultivation of a pretty tough market economy, which hurt a lot of people over 40 years. How did Lauren Berlant talk about the cruelly optimistic temptation to take our chances in a kind of stark market world?
Well, I would start by just pointing out that I think it's so interesting that part of Lauren's earlier scholarship on Hawthorne and on that historical moment in the middle of the 19th century was really attuned to the ways in which liberal institutions were being constructed and promises were being made, promises about, you know, liberal democracy and inclusivity. I don't know that neoliberalism marks a break with liberalism, but it certainly marks the withdrawal of some of those promises. One of the insights that Lauren's work offers is that just because the promises have been withdrawn or the institutions have been dismantled does not mean that people cease to be attached to them. I think that that's really the defining characteristic of cruel optimism and its analysis of neoliberalism, is that you have a kind of dismantling of material realities, defunding and dismantling of institutions, but you don't have the consequent withdrawal of the fantasy of attachment to them. It's that sense of being out of joint where your fantasy of what the world is offering you is so far from the material reality of what's on offer that really, to me, defines and distinguishes Lauren's analysis of neoliberalism. Because, you know, plenty of people have pointed out the responsabilization of the individual or the way that the rhetoric of school choice gets turned into this alibi for destroying public education and so on. But I think that the key feature of Lauren's analysis of neoliberalism has to do with that sense that the things we want and the terms of our desires and attachments to social and political reality were forged so long ago that they're no longer really relevant, and yet we can't quite shake them. You know, it's not to say can't, but perhaps that it takes a certain amount of labor and collective activity in order to reorganize the way that people desire so that their desires are more situated in their present reality.
Yeah. In my notes, I'm seeing something Berlant wrote and bears on that point, Zach. Politics is always emotional, Berlant wrote. It is a scene where structural antagonisms, genuinely conflicting interests between, say, workers and management, are described in rhetoric that intensifies fantasy. Mm-hmm. And of course, cruel optimism builds in and on that fantasy.
Yeah, I think that's a great passage. And I don't think that for Lauren, fantasy is an inherently pejorative term either.
No.
It's just the medium for political life.
Right.
It's the way that politics transpires through some form of fantasy activity. And it's important to give your fantasy life a workout if you're going to have a political life. You
right.
know,
because and it comes out of conflict and contradiction, too.
For sure.
You know, one of the fantasies of neoliberalism is that the economy is capable of infinite growth. Hmm. And one of the ways in which, you know, nations like the US and also Russia have managed to perpetuate the fantasy that the economy is capable of endless growth is to carve out new markets through these sort of neo-imperial wars. And the most obvious example would be the first and second Iraq wars. Hmm. Lauren was an extremely passionate and outspoken critic of the second Bush administration and of the Iraq war. I vividly remember attending a gallery opening for a group show that Lauren had put together with Feel Tank, which was a group of scholars and artists right. making art about politics. And they had a tagline for their group, which was, "Depressed, it might be political." And Feel Tank had a show at a gallery in Chicago, and Lauren had a piece in it, and the piece was participatory. And what it required of the audience was for everybody, one by one, to recite a speech of George W. Bush's. And to be videotaped reciting the speech. And so the idea was obviously to imagine yourself in a position of complicity with the Iraq war, which to some extent it's fair to say we all were. But then also to experience, and this goes back to the question of affect theory and the role of affect in Lauren's work, to ask yourself what kinds of emotions passed through you as you were forced to inhabit the position of George W. Bush.
Wow.
So it was a really, really interesting piece and very powerful and something that I think about a lot. But yeah, I would just want to say that in addition to being an incredible scholar and mentor, Lauren was also quite a committed activist. And so much of their thought was informed by opposition to the Iraq war.
Over to you, Maggie.
Yeah, thank you, Anahit, because I was thinking of the section in Cruel Optimism about what was then called the obesity epidemic. So a different epidemic than the one that we're living in. And part of Berlant's argument in that chapter is that the way we think about health and bodies and physical health, as well as mental health, is that people need to make better choices. Individual people need to choose to be healthier, or maybe they can't choose because their genetics has sent them out on a particular path. And that actually what we're ignoring when we think about health, both physical and mental, that way, and think about it as located in individual people, are the fact that people have to work three jobs to get by and they don't have time to make good health decisions, or the fact that healthcare is incredibly expensive and incredibly inaccessible, and just the idea of going to the doctor, or, you know, the fear of going to get a vaccine shot because it's going to cost too much, that these things are all ignored when we think about shared problems as individual problems and people making good or bad choices. And one other thing I love about that argument is that Berlant didn't take suffering as resistance to say, oh, well, the fact that this person is not living according to some ideal of physical health or ideal of physical beauty, oh, that's them resisting capitalism. That's them resisting these kind of oppressive situations. And Berlant's point was like, well, not really if they're suffering, you know, not really if they're in pain. That doesn't really seem like good resistance to me. So I guess to tie it back to the Feel Tank, which I think is a great image to think about together, it's not resisting through suffering or through passivity or through capitulation, but through building something new together, making something together that, as Anahit said earlier, is imagining other kinds of ways of being and other possibilities.
I want to call this radio show podcast The Field Tank, and I want to do it again with all of you. Maggie Daugherty, Anahit Nirsesian, Zach Samelin, disciples of the late, great Lauren Berlant, thank you.
Thank you so much, Chris. It was a pleasure talking to all of you.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks very much for having me, Chris, and very nice to talk to you, Maggie and Anahid.
Maggie Daugherty is the author of The Equivalence. Anahid Nersesian at UCLA wrote Keats's Odes, A Lover's Discourse. Zachary Samelin's new book is called The Masses Are Revolting. He teaches at NYU. Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks, with engineering help from the WBUR production team. Mary McGrath is everybody's mentor. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source. Open Source is a proud member of Hub and Spoke, a nonprofit audio collective bringing you some of the smartest podcasts out there. This week, check out the latest episode of Subtitle, the show all about languages and the people who speak them. Host Patrick Cox asks, who writes the fortunes in fortune cookies? And where do fortune cookies even come from? Find that episode at subtitlepod.com. And check out the whole Hub and Spoke lineup at hubspokeaudio.org.
Hub and Spoke. Audio Collective.